From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is Ryan Lessard.
I don't know what to tell you. Like, I'm not macabre. I'm not like the guy from Harold and Maude. You know, I'm not obsessed with death.
Full disclosure, he used to work for NHPR. And if it weren't for him, this story probably would never have happened.
I like to read and think about stuff that is maybe uncomfortable for most people.
For a long time, Ryan had been thinking about what will happen to his body when he dies. Today, his body is wearing a pair of narrow glasses and a flannel shirt.
I don't know how to introduce myself.
His wife, Sinahan, is sitting next to him in Ryan's video game chair. There's an album of wedding photos placed nonchalantly on the table.
Yeah, actually, it's funny. When we first started dating, when we were in that, like, getting to know you phase and we're asking each other about a bunch of different things, I think I'm the one who brought it up first. And I said, well, when I die, I want to be a tree. And I kind of laughed because I didn't know how he was going to take it. And Ryan was like, yeah, me too. I want to be a tree too.
That's how we jokingly say it, be a tree, you know, like the Lion King circle of life thing.
Yeah, just like Mufasa said, you know, when we die, our bodies become the grass and the antelopes eat the grass.
And the more we compared notes on the little finer details, like, you know, not being embalmed, not having a casket, and then the actual tree, you know, that was a sign. It wasn't the only sign, but it was a sign.
No, we figured out we're the same brand of weird, and it works for us, so.
Ryan and Sinahan aren't what you'd call green warriors. They don't have solar panels or a compost bin. They are not a zero-waste home. But their philosophy about what should be done with their bodies after they die, it's part of what's called the green burial movement.
You tell people this idea, and they think you're some hippy-dippy new age spiritualist, but I actually come from it from a more rational standpoint. It serves no real purpose to embalm and entomb yourself. What good does it do? Who's getting this resource? The toll collectors to the underworld. The funeral industry. Yeah. You know.
Today on Outside In, a look at the growing number of people, like Ryan and Sinahan, who want to forego embalming, caskets, and big granite monuments in favor of a more natural burial, and why that's easier said than done. Before we get going, I do want to be serious for a minute. In this episode, we'll be discussing and describing dead bodies and funeral practices. Some of it is gross, and if you've recently lost a loved one or are sensitive or squeamish about death, you might want to skip this one. If, however, you find death sort of grotesquely fascinating, enjoy! All right, you've been warned. Here's Taylor Quimby. So, before I tell you about green burial and our two future trees, Ryan and Sinahan, first I have to tell you about the machine they want to disrupt, the modern American funeral industry. The moment you die, that's the moment this machine whirs to life. This machine, unless someone shows you how to operate the thing, it'll scoop up your mortal coil and place it on a conveyor belt. And from there, all sorts of things will happen. The machine will preserve your body, package it, and process it, and that'll be that.
Everything's so fast these days. Everybody needs, it's all convenient. We need to get it all done. It's one-stop shopping. It's that Walmart mentality.
This is Mandy Damaris, a funeral director with Fineff Funeral Home, one of New Hampshire's largest providers of cremations and funeral services. She's warm and welcoming. And, of course, dressed in shades of black.
So what you see most of these days is it's called a same-day service. Everybody comes in, you have an hour of visitation, you go off to the church, or even stay in the funeral home for your service, go to the cemetery and done, all in one day. So we see that a lot more.
Fineff, like a lot of funeral homes today, is a one-stop body shop.
I'll give you the grand tour.
Great.
There's enough room to hold three memorial services side by side. There are three crematoriums, a room to shop for caskets, a room to shop for urns.
All of our chapels are equipped with flat screen TVs where we can do slideshows for the family.
Pretty standard funeral fare. But how exactly did we get here? First, let's travel back to April of 1865, when a tall, lanky, and famously bearded corpse took an open casket tour of America.
Abraham Lincoln, after he died, his body was embalmed and re-embalmed and bombed and re-embalmed, and they traveled him across the country on a parade for Americans to sort of gaze at his body.
This is Suzanne Kelly, a green burial advocate, historian, and author of the book Greening Death.
They actually disinterred his son during that parade as well, and brought him on the parade.
Weird.
Yeah.
Now, preserving human bodies is an age-old practice. But Abe Lincoln's funeral tour and the embalming of Union soldiers, it was all the beginning of this new movement in America, the rural cemetery movement.
The idea of embalming at that time was hitched to the idea not just of preservation in terms of gazing upon a body that was preserved like Abraham Lincoln's body, but the idea that the dead body needed to be cleansed of its filth.
A quick note here, this idea that embalming is a form of sanitation, bogus. We now understand embalming serves no medical purpose. In fact, if you're dealing with people who died of infectious diseases, think Ebola, for example, embalming is really dangerous. But people didn't really understand how disease worked yet.
There was a belief at the time that if something smelled bad, it was the miasma theory, that people could actually get sick and die. And so what started to happen in towns and villages and these rising urban centers was that the dead were sort of pushed to the outskirts of town.
For ages, funerals had been a very DIY affair. Families took charge of most of the details, often in their own homes. Now, you needed a trained professional to embalm a body, to cleanse it, and later to sell you a fancy casket and coordinate with the bucolic new cemeteries. And thus, the machine was born. Let me take you on a little tour. Imagine a man dies quietly in his sleep. We'll call him Pluto, for you historians of Roman history out there. Before anything happens, there will be a discussion with Pluto's family about how this machine works, what buttons they're allowed to press, and how much stuff costs. But it's a lot to take in. So let's skip ahead to the first big stop, the embalming. Not legally required, but let's say Pluto's family goes for it. The machine kicks into action. First, it sets his face. A little super glue on Pluto's eyelids to keep him from peeking. Pack up his cheeks with putty, sculpt a pleasant expression. Then it sews his jaws closed by means of a wire, forced through the gums, then up through the back of the nostrils and tied off. Plug up the orifices, you know which ones I'm talking about. Then make a couple incisions in Pluto's neck and turn on the pump. That forces out his blood and replaces it with a chemical cocktail. Then, almost over, I promise, the machine punctures Pluto's belly with a long, skinny metal tube called a trocar, sucks out all his organ fluids and bubbling gases. Fill him back up with a little more preservative, plug up the hole, and voila, step one complete. Next stop on the conveyor belt, cosmetics. A new suit, makeup on the face and hands, wash the body, spruce up the hair. Okay, now that Pluto's looking good, it's time to show him off. Simple pine coffins used to be pretty standard, but this machine has better ideas. And for this part, Pluto's family has got some big choices to make.
Sealed versus non-sealed, wood versus metal, you know, helping them understand what, you know, what the functionality is versus what's just for show, you know, not for show, but, you know, decorative.
If they've got enough dough, they could spend 12 grand for the Cadillac of caskets. But most models here are between 3 and 5. Each one has a name, like a car or an IKEA nightstand. There's Hamilton, Edison, Monarch, Devotion. Caskets made from mahogany, maple, steel, even solid copper. Going with the Hamilton, I see. Very trendy choice right now. Pluto's nearing the end of the conveyor belt here, but not before he arrives at the burial vault section. And what is a burial vault, you ask? Well, it's sort of like a casket for your casket. A big hefty box made of concrete, plastics, and metals. Once cemeteries got moved towards the outskirts of town, they started being managed like parks. Nicely mowed grass, paved pathways, big granite monuments. As it turns out, burying bodies is bad for landscaping.
If you're running along with a lawnmower in the cemetery and you don't put a vault into the ground, when a body decays, you're going to have a divot, right? You're going to have a kind of a depression in the ground, right? And so it doesn't make it easy for the lawnmower to go over that depression.
You know, it's not just to look pretty. You know, there's a lot of heavy equipment in cemeteries that, you know, if they're driving over graves, you want to know that, you know, your loved one's body is preserved and cared for and protected underground, so.
Just in terms of, like, compression.
Mm-hmm. Yep, load bearing, yeah, exactly. And, you know, they're all sealed, so there's, you know, there's no chance of elements or, you know, little critters getting in there, and that, you know, that makes people feel better, for sure.
So here's the thing about this machine. It's automated, it's convenient, and it makes money. And just like a lot of other automated, convenient money-making machines, people like it. Death is weird and kind of taboo. Better to let the machine take care of it. But over time, it got more complicated and more expensive, and eventually someone started asking questions. In 1964, an author and journalist named Jessica Mitford published The American Way of Death. She lambasted the expensive products, the clever euphemisms, and the marketing. She went undercover and recorded a number of funeral directors falsely stating their products were mandated by law. A few years before her death in 1996, she was interviewed on stage by the writer and rabble-rouser Christopher Hitchens.
Is it actually true that there was a casket named after you by an ungracious undertaker?
Yeah, well, actually, I had a letter from a manufacturer in the Middle West with plans and specifications for what he was going to market as the Jessica Mitford casket. Yeah. And it was going to be made as a rather cheap cardboard, you know. And it wasn't a thought of that.
Mitford's book was a huge hit. It sparked congressional hearings and new consumer protections. Burial costs went down. Cremations went up. When it was first published, about 3% of Americans were cremated. Today, that number is 43% and rising.
It's become the norm. We needed to put in a third cremation chamber just to keep up with it. You know, we can do 12 cremations a day, every day. Yeah, it's pretty...
With using all three?
All three. Yeah, yeah, we do a three cremation rotation every 4 hours. Cremations at 8, noon, 4, and 8.
So in a lot of ways, green burial is just the next logical step in that same backlash. Another attempt to get off the conveyor belt once and for all. No embalming, no big heavy casket, no concrete liner. Do not pass go, do not collect $200. But where cremation continues to take off, green burial, well, it just hasn't really caught on. And sure, part of that has to do with the American funeral industry, but it's not the only thing holding it back. The first green or natural burial ground in America opened in Westminster, South Carolina in 1998. It's called Ramsey Creek, and it's the brainchild of two very green bodies, Dr. Billy Campbell, the town physician, and his wife, Kimberly.
I moved actually in the late 70s. I'm nearly native.
Close enough. Now, Ramsey Creek doesn't look anything like your ordinary cemetery.
Well, first of all, let me say that we don't like to use the word cemetery.
What it really looks like is a small park, about 85 acres, with an old country house, a barn, a chapel, and a series of little paths. I've seen pictures, and if you're not paying attention, I'm not sure you'd even see the little flat stones that pepper the ground just off the trails. Those are gravesites, but they blend right into the landscape. It is not a place that screams death, and Kimberly says that's part of the point.
We've had weddings there. We've had baby blessings there. We've had environmental education seminars there. Dogs are always welcome. Of course, we do pet burials.
How many people are buried on the site?
We have over 400 people, which includes pets, I guess, buried at Ramsey Creek, with more in sales.
I think of conservationists like Billy and Kimberly as the vegans of the green burial movement. They came first. And they weren't protesting outside of funeral homes or anything. They just represent one extreme on the spectrum of environmental action.
For them, green burial isn't just a personal choice, it's a grand mission.
Our focus is finding a funding mechanism to raise money for buying land and doing what we call CPR for the land, conservation, preservation, restoration.
And with that mission comes a lot of rules. No invasive flowers or plants, no conventional headstones, no extensive landscaping, low burial density, opportunities for scientific research, education, and most importantly, burial grounds that further conservation, that buy up land. To them, anything less than that dilutes the power and potential of the green burial movement.
Thank you for calling the Green Burial Council. Our normal business hours are 9 a.m.
That's why in the early 2000s, another green burial vegan named Joe Sihe paired up with the Campbells and they started the Green Burial Council. Kate Kalanick is currently its executive director.
Do you want me to just start spotting off numbers here for you?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Okay.
Kate will tell you that traditional burials use up to 33 million board feet worth of wood every year, enough wood to build more than 2,000 single-family homes.
At that point, we're using 5 million gallons of embalming fluid, which contains, obviously, the carcinogen formaldehyde.
But not everybody interested in green burial is actually focused on the quote-unquote green part.
One of the things that I find interesting is that for religious and secular people alike who are attracted to green burial, they'll often quote that kind of biblical wisdom tradition of dust to dust, earth to earth, ashes to ashes. And that's something that they're seeking, at least spiritually, even if it's not part of their kind of religious background.
These are the folks I call the green burial vegetarians. And lots of them are people of faith, like Ben Stewart.
So I'm Ben Stewart. I'm an associate professor of worship at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago.
After Ramsey Creek, some of the first people to pursue green cemeteries were priests and rabbis. But they weren't always doing it in the way that the Green Burial Council would have preferred.
In the Jewish tradition, typically you don't embalm a body, but if you have to fly somebody across the ocean to go home, then embalm the body. Because in the end, the question is about the dignity of this beautiful vessel of God. And that logic is beautiful in the natural burial movement.
In a way, Jews and Muslims, they're the OGs of the green burial movement. They've been carrying on traditions of simple earth-to-earth burials since whenever. But they haven't totally escaped the machine either. In order to make sure Jewish bodies are quote-unquote in contact with the earth, funeral homes will drill holes in the bottoms of expensive caskets. And they'll place burial vaults upside down over the body, a practice called butter dishing.
Oh, for me, I grew up Christian. You know, obviously there's a big emphasis on the afterlife.
Catholic?
No, Protestant.
This brings us to a third category. If the conservationists are green burial vegans, and the faithful, concerned about the dignity of the holy vessel, are green burial vegetarians, then Ryan and Sinahan are burial ground pescatarians? Burial ground organic? Gluten-free burial grounders. Folks who are in it for personal reasons.
I don't know that spirituality plays that much of a role, and I don't know that it should, honestly, because spirituality should be more about, how you conduct yourself in life and where you believe you're going to go when you're dead, if anywhere. And it shouldn't cost thousands of dollars, if you want to get to it. It shouldn't cost thousands of dollars to die. That should be the least expensive thing you do.
They all want to get off the machine. But in a way, many of these folks are at odds with one another. The green burial vegans aren't happy about conventional cemeteries that allow green burial, which they think misses a big part of the environmental message. Green burial vegetarians, like Benjamin Stewart, want funerals to emphasize our commonality. Meanwhile, many gluten-free burial grounders are looking towards green burial to set themselves apart. These divisions have played out physically in cemeteries all over the country. Vegans, as led by the GBC, have pushed for full-on preservation-style burial grounds, burial parks, more or less. Vegetarians and gluten-free folks, they pave the way for what are called hybrids, normal cemeteries that just have sections devoted to green burial that don't require caskets or burial vaults. In 2014, Kate Kalanick took over the Green Burial Council and started pushing the GBC to embrace the hybrid model. From her perspective, the hardline approach wasn't doing green burial any favors.
It is extremely important to the council for people to have options in their disposition. And the way to create options is for us to certify these conventional burial grounds, because let's be real here. There's a lot more conventional burial grounds than there is green burial grounds. So how do you reach the masses? Through these locations that are literally everywhere.
The idea here is that instead of trying to get off the machine, why not just put a new button on the machine?
You have selected green burial.
After all, when someone dies, who do you call? A funeral director. And if they don't offer the option, not many people are going to know to ask for it. But once a machine gets going, well, you know what happens. It starts to pump out products. All sorts of products.
Everything began with just an idea. The idea to convert cemeteries into forests. Then that idea became the BioZurn, a biodegradable urn designed to convert you into a tree after life.
This is an ad for the BioZurn and InCube, a waist-high milk-white container where you can bury your cremated ashes and plant and nurture a sapling tree.
You have selected the BioZurn.
There are plain white shrouds.
You have selected a plain shroud.
But also all sorts of different caskets.
You have selected cardboard.
Ranging from $15 for cardboard to a few hundred for the fancier options.
Press 1 to upgrade to a handmade wicker casket.
If you want to get super weird, the company Coeo offers something called the Infinity Suit.
So I'm here to explain why I'm wearing these ninja pajamas.
The suit looks sort of like a black Snuggie, covered in decomposition-enhancing mushroom spores.
So some of you may know about the chemical bisphenol A.
The spores supposedly clean up your body's toxins. The creator did a TED Talk about it, because there's a TED Talk about everything.
I believe this is the beginning of true environmental responsibility. Thank you.
For the vegans, this is what happens when a movement gets co-opted, greenwashed, sold out. This is what happens when the machine takes over the movement.
For maple, press one to upgrade.
For you have selected the inner shroud wash.
Press hit the two left one. You have selected for mango. For press.
I mean, I don't know that I necessarily want to comment on those products, but I'll just say that the movement is not a movement of products. The movement is a movement of meaning.
Here's Joe Seavey, founder of the GBC.
There's this spiritual essence that draws people in. So people may feel like they can connect with it by making a gesture and participating in a ritual that may be absolutely superficial, but is meaningful unless someone says, that's bullshit. You realize that, you know, just so we're clear here.
So what are you to make of it all? The products, the fight over special graveyards versus regular graveyards, the cardboard caskets versus the fancy ones made from exotic hardwoods. What all of this really tells you is that, big shock here, what you want to do with your body is a super personal decision. But let's say you want to get off the machine. No products, no frills, costs under $1,000. Can you? Well, let's find out.
Introduce yourself. Sure. My name is Buddy Feneff, and I'm the president of Feneff Funeral Homes and Crematorium and our sister company, the Cremation Society of New Hampshire, and a fourth-generation funeral director.
Remember Mandy from the beginning of the story?
So this is one of our new additions. This is the cafe. People love this.
Well, this is Mandy's boss, Buddy. He's got a strong handshake, a well-tailored suit, smiles like a more handsome version of William H. Macy. He's careful not to dismiss green burial because, after all, Feneff is the only funeral home in the state that openly advertises a green burial package, but he says the name can be misleading.
People think green equals inexpensive, and as we know that anyone who owns a Prius or anyone that's, you know, it doesn't mean that. So we have a lot of people coming in that say, yep, I'm interested in green burial, and we have green burial packages, and when they realize, oh, there's a casket, no, I got to pay for the cemetery, oh, no, this is not a $500 or $600 thing. No thanks, let's talk about cremation.
Buddy says that cremation is always, always cheaper than green burial. But since we're on the subject of prices, let's point out a couple things here. At $4,155, Feneff's green burial package isn't cheap, but it is $3,000 less than the next cheapest option. So not exactly peanuts. However, the green burial package doesn't include a burial vault, which you will need if there isn't a green cemetery nearby.
First off, there's lots of rules and regulations around opening a cemetery, and you can't say, I want to do a green cemetery, and then a year later say, not a great idea, now I want to put condos up. I mean, once you commit to a cemetery, it's forever.
While green burial grounds are popping up here and there, there still aren't that many.
My name's Taylor. I'm a producer with...
It took me a few days to get in touch with a trustee from Chikorawa Cemetery, a municipal burial ground in Tamworth, New Hampshire, one of four supposed green burial sites in the state.
So do you not require vaults?
This one is what people call a hybrid. The plots only cost $600, but in 3 years, they've only sold two. I asked the trustee if the green burial ground was open to everyone or just the town residents.
Is that how this works, or is it for anybody who is interested?
He said he wasn't sure, and he'd have to get back to me.
You don't really even have policies on it because it hasn't come up.
Plus, with hardly any green cemeteries around, funeral directors aren't under a lot of pressure to provide or even learn about the practice.
I'm wondering, do you offer assistance or packages for green burial services?
I cold called a handful of funeral homes in the area and asked if they would assist a family with green burial.
So no casket, maybe a shroud?
One of them said yes. One said he'd never heard of it.
Do you require embalming? Do you know?
And the rest said, I'm not sure. I'll get back to you.
No, that's okay. All right, thank you.
Here's my conclusion. You want to get off the machine? You can. People do it. But it's really, really, really hard. You need to think about this way in advance. You'd need to do a home funeral, probably, or nix it entirely. File your own paperwork, skip all the extras, maybe even arrange to have a body buried on your property. All of which are technically legal here in New Hampshire. But every state has its own set of hurdles and rules. With a little research and pre-planning, you can figure something out. Maybe get close to what you wanted and cut costs by even a few thousand dollars. But all in all, you can see why Buddy is a little skeptical. You might not love the machine, but it gets the job done. So while you're listening to this story, in the back of your head, you're probably thinking about yourself. About what you want to happen when you die. And maybe you're thinking about this hypothetically, like, you know, what would happen if I won the lottery? But spoiler alert, your death is not hypothetical. It's gonna happen.
Have you guys, like, planned it more? Like, you know, like...
Not really. We've just been too busy to give it that much thought. I mean,
oh my goodness, Ryan. After all this? Here's the thing, folks. If you don't start talking about this now, like right now, there are no guarantees. So do a little Googling, come up with a plan, and put it on a piece of paper. Because if you don't, if you keep pushing it off, one day, the machine will whir to life. And that'll be that. No matter how badly you wanted to be a tree.
I'd like to think that most of our not planning comes from not planning to die anytime soon. We're both pretty young and
Nobody
healthy.
Nobody plans to die.
don't jinx it.
That story was produced by Taylor Quimby. And in case you want to know more about green burial or about your own after-death options, we put some resources up on our website, outsideinradio.org. Check them out. And coming up, we've got more of your burning death questions. Like, can I have a Viking funeral?
Oh, one of my favorite questions. No.
No?
I'm sorry.
Outside In continues in just a minute. Welcome back. I'm Sam Evans Brown, and this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. Before the break, we heard a story about green burial, and I guess about burial in general, and whether or not being buried gets us closer to the earth, physically, spiritually, etc., or whether burial does the opposite. Now, the person who originally suggested we do a story about green burial is a woman named Kelsey Erickson. And when she was younger, she used to transport bodies for a living.
The first time I ever went to do a transporting job, I accidentally dropped the body on the floor, and the back of her head kind of split open a bit, and then blood started pouring out of her brain. So that was scary.
Kelsey runs a podcast called Deathcast, and unlike Ryan, she has her death all planned out, like it's a wedding.
Oh, yeah, I have a plan for everything. I am doing direct cremation and then scatter. But I have an advance directive. I have wills. I have a whole, basically a whole sheet or like a binder of like, if I die, do all of this stuff. I always carry empty copies of advanced directives with me. And
wait,
try
do you
to
have one right now?
I don't have one in my bag right now, but it's in my car. Okay. I thought if I brought them with me, it would be like ultra creepy. So I didn't want to like, I needed to gauge like my creepiness.
Now, scattering your ashes, that's an option you've probably heard of. But it turns out there's this whole subculture of unique post-life experiences out there. Stuff you only learn about if you're talking to someone like Kelsey.
My husband still is up in the air. He doesn't know of whether he wants to be put in a memorial reef, which is something where they take your cremated ashes and they put it in like this concrete slurry, and then they take this like giant column almost of other people's ashes of loved ones and they put it inside a barrier reef. He also, you know, he doesn't know if he wants to do that or like be pressed into a diamond and kept in the family that way.
Cremation coral reefs? Diamond ashes? The more you talk to a person like Kelsey, the more you realize, I am not informed. I have not done my death homework.
I don't have my 401k planned right now at my new job, but like, if I die the next day, I got all that paperwork there. Nobody needs to do nothing.
So back in December, while Taylor was busy working on his story, the rest of the team, we were realizing that we had a lot of random death and burial questions. So we invited Lee Webster in to speak with us. She's education coordinator for the Green Burial Council and director of a New Hampshire funeral advocacy group. I can't guarantee that all these questions will help you with your death homework, but I may just inspire you to start asking some questions of your own. Okay, first question is from me, and it's a really important one. If someone dies who's close to me, can I build a giant Viking funeral pyre in our backyard and dispose of the body that way?
Oh, one of my favorite questions. No.
No?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. So many people want to do this, and so many people have different visions of what Viking funerals really were. And to do it the way that you're envisioning is probably going to draw the attention of a government agency because of our anti-desecration laws.
Oh, wow. Okay, hang on. So two things that I want to dig into there. What was the way that the Vikings actually disposed of their bodies?
They really didn't do a lot of flaming arrows out into the sea. You know, they were land barriers, too.
That's super disappointing.
It is. I mean, it looked really good when Sean Connery went across the water, man, but that's not necessarily what really happened.
But then anti-desecration laws? What are we?
Yes. This is essentially the set of laws that we adhere to in the United States that make sure that people don't dispose of bodies without the proper authorities knowing what happened to it and where it's going to end up. So, and it also ensures that people are buried or are disposed of with dignity. So there's just this whole set of really stodgy, boring laws that tells you what you can and can't do. And one of them is to, you know, just sort of leave bodies out on the street.
This is Molly Donahue. I'm a producer for Outside In. You know, we hear a lot about home burials and home funerals, but are there authorities that come and check and make sure that, like, this body you're burying on your property isn't somebody you've just murdered?
No, there are no funeral police.
Oh, no.
Isn't that great? You know, people are always asking me this, and they always bring up the second question usually is, can I take a body across state lines? Mm-hmm. And I ask them when the last time was that they went to Vermont and somebody stopped them at the border to check their trunk for a dead body. But this doesn't mean that there aren't checks that are in place so that, no, you're not going to be finding bodies and sort of dumping them on your property. There is a process, and however much family chooses to deal with a loved one who's dying or has died, in New Hampshire, we're really fortunate because we can take care of that all by ourselves. We don't have to hire anyone to help. But there are forms we have to fill out. We have to complete death certificates. We have to get transport permits and that type of thing. And if we're going to bury on our own property, we're going to file that burial permit, essentially, with the town clerk. So there are little steps all along the way that ensure that we inform the state about what that person died of. So we're keeping all of our health statistics in place. And we're making sure that that person, again, is buried or cremated with dignity.
I'm Logan Shannon. I'm one of the producers on Outside In. So my question is actually about cremation.
Sure.
And what happens after cremation? Are there regulations about where you can choose to scatter the ashes of a loved one? Can you take them to the mountain and put a little on a trail that they like to hike on? Or can you drop some in the ocean or a lake? Like, are there regulations about that?
No, it's a full go. Other than the beach, because one of the things you need to understand, people don't understand, they call them ashes, but they're really not. They're pulverized bone, and they aren't often pulverized all the way, and it's pretty easy to tell what it is. So you don't want to find it with your two-year-old on the beach. These remains are essentially boiled down to their base element, right? So what it is calcium phosphate and sodium. And that means that it can go into water. It's not a big deal. Sodium is water soluble. Calcium is not a big deal either. There are no real hard and fast rules with state or national parks. For instance, they have paperwork, but you know how they are. They really don't want you to fill it out. So they're very happy. Go ahead, as you know, just make sure that you're discreet and there's not a 50 Girl Scouts coming behind you, little brownie scouts on their first trek. But here's the biggest thing I'm concerned about with cremains is that that sodium that's in them, they're very, very heavy because it's dense bone and the salt. And if you scatter those at higher altitudes, if you scatter them anywhere on top of a fragile foliage, you're killing it.
Oh.
So this idea that people have always had about planting it a rose bush, right? And well, good luck with that, because the roots all are going to grow as far away from sodium as they possibly can. Uh-huh. What we're finding in national parks is, particularly out west, is that people are finding, they want to take their loved one to a place that has meaning to them. So they go to Zion or someplace like that, and they dump all this stuff right on top of this very fragile vegetation.
So what about if we want to leave a body on the roof for the vultures to eat it?
Again, anti-desecration. Then there's the issue of what vultures are you planning to enlist for this job? I don't know about you, but here in New Hampshire, I don't see a lot.
So no on that one.
People are always asking me, I just want to die on my own land. I just want to, have somebody just drag me out to the woods and let all the wild animals take care of me. And it's always fascinating to me because I'm thinking what their face would look like if somebody else in the neighborhood did that and their dog went out and brought home some kind of a juicy joint. I just can't imagine what people are thinking.
What's the most like, what's the most natural way to be disposed of after you die? Like, what's the most efficient, I guess, efficient sounds kind of cold, but a way to really, after you pass away, to return to the earth? What's the best way?
Yeah, absolute best way, both chemically and spiritually, is through burial. And what we found with what we're calling green burial now, which is really just burial, the bodies themselves, even now with all the heavy metals that we are accumulating now that we didn't before, soil with the right temperatures and the right humidity and so on creates the perfect environment at about 3.5 to 4 feet, where all those lovely little microbes and all that active insect population, I mean, the insects at that level are often named things like coffin bugs. Okay, we have names for them because that's where the action is.
See, I've always really felt that I didn't want to be buried because I didn't want to take up space. Like, I always feel when I go to cemeteries that I'm always kind of bummed out that people aren't playing, like there's no activity happening there. It's just, I always felt like it would be neat if all the gravestones were sort of in a perimeter so that everyone could play on the green space in the middle. And I always thought, well, I'd rather be cremated because I'm just not going to take up a bunch of space.
Yeah, and you've really come to the root of it as far as I'm concerned. It's amazing to me in one way and in not in another. Americans are very individualistic, right? And we all have this sense of entitlement about certain things. And one of them seems to be that we think we have the right to own a piece of property on the planet forever, in perpetuity, even after we're gone. And what that's creating, of course, is these, parking lots for concrete and Chinese steel and rainforest woods and so on, that isn't ever going to be used for any other purpose. And the point of green burial, certainly you could have recreational areas, you can continue to do sustainable agriculture, all kinds of life-affirming activities that go on above ground. What we've found, we've done studies, and we've found that the reason that more people come to green burial cemeteries, they don't come to put flowers on a grave in May. They come to birdwatch. That's their favorite thing. They come to hike. They cross-country ski. They have picnics. They do all the things that people used to do before we went to this lawn cemetery model, which is relatively new. Here's what's happening in our communities, and I can give you the example. I live in Plymouth, and we're on our 14th cemetery. So we keep filling them up, and then we have to go look for new land. Well, what does that mean when you live, like I do, in the Lakes region, and property values are skyrocketing, and the town, because the state mandates it, has to provide that burial space for a one use only each time? Green burial means, if we can give up this personal idea, green burial means that we can reuse space. We don't have to lay people out like cordwood.
Lee Webster, thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much for having me.
Did you have something else you wanted to ask?
I did, actually, Lee.
Okay. Go.
Now, this is a side. How pointless are mausoleums?
Oh, God. Just don't get me started on this one.
So being that this is the last episode of our spring season, you know, the time of rebirth, it does seem a little macabre to end the show talking about dead bodies and decomposition. So after a break, we're going to look at the sunnier side of a similar process, fermentation.
Whoops, sorry. No worries.
A guy who will make booze out of just about anything.
If it smells like baby wipes, I'm really gonna freak out.
When Outside In continues.
I would say this tastes like nothing I've ever had.
Occasionally, we here at Outside In like to talk about invasive species. But we've got our own way of going about it.
No other species can defeat them.
They're invasive.
So why don't we just freaking eat them?
Because we're hungry.
Eat the invaders.
This is Eat the Invaders, where we talk about dealing with invasive species using the somewhat questionable strategy of eating them. This is Japanese knotweed. It's a plant which was introduced, as so many of them are, because it has beautiful flowers and is really easy to grow. In Japan, when a volcano erupts and buries the land in magma, knotweed is often the first plant to break through the rocks and recolonize. It looks sort of like bamboo, with broad, tear-shaped leaves and tall, segmented stalks that can grow to be over your head. But here in the US, knotweed is a problem, and it is tenacious. It can grow through foundations, tear apart pavement or stone walls, or just take over your yard. But there's at least a little bit of good news.
In another week or two, as it warms up here, it's going to send up these little shoots. And when it sends those up, the first foot, foot and a half, is edible like asparagus.
That's Ken Hardcastle. He's a winemaker.
What's it taste like?
It's not as nice as asparagus for myself.
So I used to have knotweed that grew up all around my house when I was a kid.
And this is Taylor Quimby, our producer.
And I used to just eat it right off the stalk.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, so, like a lot of it.
A lot of it?
Yeah.
Wow.
I used to go out with a wiffle ball bat, and my parents would be happy to just send me off, and I would smash it down. This stuff really comes, this has that nice crack to it.
We're standing in Ken's yard, where alongside a quaint little stream and nearby stone wall, there are two long rows of last year's knotweed, standing 7 or 8 feet high. Now it's all dry and brittle, which, I will say, makes the idea of going into a field of this stuff with a wiffle ball bat seem pretty appealing.
We have hackers and whackers and all sorts of things, and we come out here in the evening, spend an hour just packing the crap out of it, you know?
It's all your stress, gone.
It's perfect. It's great. I've had friends come over and grab some sort of implement and head out into the woods and just hack Japanese knotweed for a while.
Let me interrupt this regularly scheduled Eat the Invaders segment with a little PSA. If your goal is to limit the spread of this invasive, this is a terrible idea.
Well, I wouldn't recommend that.
Doug Cyan is the state invasive species coordinator and says that even a tiny fragment of the stem, crown, or root can turn into a whole new plant. And what's more, cutting it stimulates growth.
So if you had just a few square feet of stems, all of a sudden you cut it, and the next year you could have, you know, exponential number of square footage of stems.
So Ken and Taylor's chopping probably has led their plants to spread exponentially. Should you actually want to get rid of knotweed, you can spray it with herbicides, or you can cut it down, dry it, burn it, cover the entire area where the knotweed was with the thickest tarp you can find, bury the tarp with wood chips, and leave it there for 5 years straight. So yeah, this stuff is invasive. But for Ken, who loves experimenting with things in order to make wine, and whose blueberry wine was good enough that it was featured on the Today Show, knotweed presented an opportunity.
What I did try doing was to ferment it, because the plant is all over my backyard, and it's supposedly loaded with resveratrol, which is a good antioxidant that's in red wine grapes. So I thought, oh, this is related in some way to red wine. Let's see if we can make wine out of it. So I collect the shoots when they come up, and chop those up and throw them in a fermenter.
Fermentation is a pretty simple process. First, you need yeast and you need sugars. And then you just need to provide a nice environment that the yeast will like to grow in. Certain yeasts will eat the sugar and then basically crap out alcohol.
So I take the plant, put it in some water, and add some sort of fermentable. Honey, maple sap, syrup, corn sugar, anything you got that has sugar in it.
Ken says that process of making alcohol will pull nutrients and color and flavor out of the knotweed or rhubarb or whatever you've got in there and stick it into the liquid.
I made a straight up Japanese knotweed wine when I first made it, after it was in the bottle, pouring it for my colleagues. They were amazed at how it smelled. It had this bouquet of baby wipes. Something you pull out of the box. It smelled just like baby wipes.
The thing about a bottle of wine is the taste and smell changes as it ages. Ken says the baby wipe smell went away after the bottles sat on the shelf for a few years.
Watch your head down here. It's a little tight and old and gnarly.
Now we're in Ken's basement. It's an old school, dusty, cobwebby, dirt floored, kinda wet New England farmhouse basement. This is where he's got one last bottle of the wine that he made years ago out of knotweed.
So this is
K2.
K2, that's the second version of my Japanese knotweed wine where we blended in some blackberries from outside. And we're gonna bring this upstairs and pull the cork on it.
Do you want me to hold it?
Yeah, sure.
So how long has it been since you opened one of these bottles?
Probably 3 years.
So is it fair to say you don't know what this will taste like?
I think I know what it tastes like. But I'm sure I'm going to be surprised. If it smells like baby wipes, I'm really going to freak out. Whoops, sorry.
No worries. I will say that if you were to ask me to characterize this, complex is definitely a word I would use. And also I would say that that it being an easy drinking wine is probably not words I would use to describe it. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, this is a contemplative wine.
Ultimately, even the knotweed blackberry wine was a little too weird to try to sell in the winery. But the experiment did get another idea swirling around in Ken's head, one that ultimately was economically viable.
This plant, you let it grow like it likes to do, and in August, it sends out these tall, long fronds of little tiny white flowers. They're just loaded. It's beautiful. It's a decorative plant. It's a gorgeous plant. Bees love those flowers. They're going after these flowers, and they're taking that nectar back to their hive. The honey that's put up from Japanese knotweed looks like molasses. People call it black bamboo honey. It's fantastic. It's a very distinctive, very unique honey. I make mead out of that.
Mead, the alcoholic beverage associated with fantasy, Beowulf, Vikings, and Robin Hood's Friar Tuck. It's a drink that's made from fermented honey, and it seems to be making a comeback in certain circles. One newspaper even dubbed it the Game of Thrones effect.
So I make a honey wine commercially at Hermit Woods Winery made out of the flowers, the nectar from the flowers of Japanese knotweed. We call it knot mead, K-N-O-T, mead.
When we talk about making a honey out of a plant that's an invasive species, if the strategy of eating an invasive species is also a way of getting rid of it, making honey means that you have to wait for it to flower. So it's kind of the opposite.
Well, here's the question. Why do you want to get rid of it if you're getting really nice honey from it? Is it an invasive when it's something that's valuable?
Okay, the truth is, Ken's goal was never really to try to get rid of his knotweed. In fact, his philosophy has a lot more to do with the final product than any thought of keeping invasive species under control. His big idea is that we should be making alcohol out of things that grow really well in our own backyards. And this all started after the first time he tried blueberry wine.
The next day, my buddy Chuck showed up on my doorstep with a bucket full of blueberries and said, Ken, make wine like that.
He's since branched out to try adding random plants that are decidedly not sweet.
Sumac, staghorn sumac, this plant behind us right here, I use it as a natural form of tannin into my blueberry wines and other things to give it more grip.
And he's even made a white wine from heirloom tomatoes that he says tastes just like Chardonnay.
So are you just, when you go for a walk out here, are you just looking around you thinking like, what around me could I turn into booze?
Yeah, always. You let the Saccharomyces on there, the critter that eats sugar and makes alcohol, do its magic, and you end up with this liquid that's nutritious and connects you to your gods and Mother Earth in new ways.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody refer to getting schwasted that way.
Well, that's the way I see it. And actually, you take a honey wine and you connect to Mother Earth like no other product on the planet.
So for Ken, this is not really about eating invasives. It's more like, hey, we should be enjoying what grows in our backyard. So what's the problem with that?
Commercially, people harvest asparagus. So there are devices and tools to make it efficient or ways of harvesting it with people to collect enough of it. And then I could ferment that and turn that into wine. And we won't have to spray it anymore. We'll cut it down and grow it in places so that we can craft it into a wine.
Well, this is the problem. When you get Ken excited about this idea, suddenly he's talking about deliberately planting one of the most invasive species around, which brings up a funny tension here. Remember Doug Sagan, the earnest state worker who fights invasives?
So you're friends with Ken Hardcastle, yes?
Yes, I am.
Have you been to his house?
I have been to his house.
He's got it everywhere.
He does have it everywhere.
Does he drive you crazy? I have to say that it seems like for you two to be friends is sort of like the odd couple a little bit.
It is. I love Ken. He's a great person, and I have a lot of respect for him. He wants to control that Japanese knotweed on his property. It is getting overwhelming, and with the density of the population there, you'd be hard pressed to be able to throw a baseball across it. It's pretty dense.
So obviously, Ken is not actively thinking of starting a knotweed farm, because he is in fact trying to eliminate some of the stuff on his property.
So I've been out there trying to assist him on a few weekends last year to try to get a foothold, and we're working on it.
So unlike us, you won't be able to try Ken Hardcastle's original knotweed blackberry wine. But if you want, you can go out in the spring and grab the new shoots when the plant first starts to push up from underground, like we did.
It's a lot more mild than I thought it would be.
Yeah, what did you think it was going to be?
Like super bitter.
No, it's good.
I'd eat this. I'm going to make this into a pie.
It's surprisingly tasty stuff. And in some ways, that's the problem. Because as we've learned, just cutting it actually might help it spread. The truth is, there are many invasive species that can't be controlled by eating them. And for the ones that are edible, what if they taste so good, people just want to plant more of them? Well, isn't that a pickle? Outside In is produced by Maureen McMurray, Taylor Quimby, Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, and Jimmy Gutierrez. Special thanks to Kelsey Erickson, Lee Webster, Vanef Funeral Home, Father Charles Morris, and everybody else who helped us on the Green Burial story. Also, thanks to everyone else at NHPR who makes each season of Outside In possible, especially Dan Colgan, Andrew Perella, and Betsy Gardella. Music this week from Poddington Bear, Blue Dot Sessions, Ari De Niro, and Art of Escapism, and our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. That's all we've got for this season, but seriously, if you haven't already, subscribe to the podcast. We've got a brand new episode every 2 weeks, and next up, just in time for Mother's Day, a story about the epic international journey that grocery store bouquet took to get to the shelves. So pull out your phone, hit the little podcasts icon, and search for Outside In. I'm your host, Sam Evans Brown. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
You're just like jamming your face full of chocolate and wine all at once. You're just guzzling it. It's just like it's all over the place.